It's Wednesday, May 27th, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey Stashers, Radical Russ here. You are listening to a best of the Daily Audio Stash for the week of May 26, 2009. We're getting ready for the Aspen Legal Seminar on June 4th, 5th, and 6th, so we're going to have some downtime here at the Stash. We're bringing back some of your favorites from the previous Daily Audio Stashes over the past 14 months, so you're going to get a little bit of reefer madness, some stupid stoner stories, some great cannabis science from Dr. Mitch Earlywine, and some of my favorite songs from the Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com. I'll have plenty of live information coming from Aspen Legal Seminar over the weekend of June 4th, 5th, and 6th, audio and video to be posted later. Thank you so much for understanding. Keep up on the blog at stash.normal.org. I'll be posting somewhat infrequently during these next couple of weeks, but if there's any new breaking news stories, you'll find them there on the Stash. We'll be back with all original shows on Monday, June 8th, 2009. So sit back and enjoy the best of your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Oh yeah, we got another great dose of reefer madness here. This one comes from Kentucky and the Courier Journal newspaper.
If you're a baby boomer, don't lull yourself into thinking that marijuana is a fading fad that represents a modest threat to today's youth. You'd be wrong. Nearly half of today's teenagers try marijuana before graduating from high school, and by their senior year, more than 20% are regular users, Science Daily reported in May.
But according to those same figures that describe 19.8%, not over 20, of the class of 2005 used marijuana in the last month, for the class of 1975, the baby boomers, that figure was 27.1%. In fact, in 1979, lifetime use peaked at 60.4%, and in 1978, monthly use peaked at 37.1%.
More teens use marijuana than all other illegal drugs combined, and they are at greater risk than teens who smoked pot a couple of decades ago. Jim Couser, a chemical dependency therapist in the Center for Behavioral Health at Baptist Hospital East, said, quote, "It's much more potent than what they smoked at Woodstock," end quote. A more recent style of smoking marijuana also is intensifying its impact. Dr. Elizabeth Garcia Gray, Chief Medical Officer of Child Psychiatric Services for Seven County Services, Inc., said, quote, "During the 60s, there were mostly joints. Now we have blunts, which are like two or three joints packed in one. When they pack it in blunts, the potency is much more, and if they smoke four or five blunts a day, it's like 10 to 12 joints," end quote.
Well, yeah, of course. It's like when you take one shot of 70-proof whiskey and you add it to another shot of 70-proof whiskey, you get a double shot of 140-proof whiskey, right? No, you dolt. Blunts are no more potent than joints. Marijuana is marijuana. And the size of the blunt, well, duh, that's like saying if you drink three 40-ounce beers, that's like drinking 10 12-ounce cans. It doesn't follow that if boomers smoked four or five joints in a day, that today's consumers are smoking four or five blunts in a day. People smoke to get high. If it took a whole joint of Woodstock weed, or if it takes 10 people sharing one of today's blunts, people smoke that much and stop.
Couser said cannabis may lead alcohol as the number one substance abused by teens because it is, quote, "easier to conceal and a lot more accessible," end quote, than alcohol.
Yeah, because nobody hassles you for any ID. And you can get it at high school behind the shop building from another student. And if you're caught with it, they'll take you to drug court and sentence you to rehab so Mr. Couser can keep his bed counts up.
He said the mental health consequences of marijuana use range from transient amnesia to intensifying depressive disorders. Marijuana also may trigger an early onset of schizophrenia in those at risk for the illness.
So you'd think then that you'd see rates of schizophrenia, depression, and transient amnesia, whatever that means. I think it means forgetting where you just left your keys. You'd think you'd see those rates rise and fall relative to the rates of marijuana use and potency. You go right ahead and find that data. Look hard. I'll give you a head start. Over the past 40 years, nationwide rates for schizophrenia stayed relatively constant at about 1.1% of the population. Even during the 60s summer of love, GIs returning from Vietnam in the 70s with killer jungle weed, and the 80s advent of connoisseur indoor marijuana production, and the 90s birth of medical marijuana, and all the way to today, 1.1% of the people get schizophrenia. Now, that said, it's not for adolescents. There is credible research to suggest that cannabis may increase the risk of developing schizophrenia if used heavily by teens who are predisposed to schizophrenia. But we need to avoid overreacting to the relative odds when the actual odds are still quite low. What's the difference? Well, think of it this way. Relative odds say that if you buy 10 lottery tickets, you're 10 times as likely to win the jackpot as the person who bought one ticket. Actual odds say that both of you have a greater chance of being hit by lightning.
Other dangers: lung damage and social and behavioral problems. Marijuana used when driving can make it difficult to judge distances and react to signals and sounds on the road. Marijuana affects judgment, perception, and memory, so it can mean poor performance in school, in sports, or at a job. It can lead to risky sexual behavior.
Your lung damage consists of, at worst, a hacking cough or mild bronchitis, and that's if you're bong hitting morning, noon, and night for decades. Marijuana smoking does not lead to head, neck, or lung cancers. Now, don't smoke pot at school, in sports, or at work. And practice safe sex. None of those harms are caused by marijuana. They're caused by irresponsibility, and would be twice as devastating if we were talking about irresponsible drinking.
Couser reports that withdrawal from marijuana can take longer than withdrawing from alcohol or cocaine. He said the THC in marijuana accumulates in the fat tissues, which are slow to release the chemical.
bald-faced liar. The THC-COOH metabolites accumulate in the fat tissues. These are non-psychoactive compounds that cause no withdrawal symptoms whatsoever. The THC itself is clear of your system within 2 to 4 hours.
Stupid Stoner Stories.
As a public service, Normal reminds you that smoking marijuana will not make one stupid. However, some stupid people do smoke marijuana. Don't be one of those stoners that make the rest of us look bad. Learn your lesson from today's
Stupid Stoner Story.
Pot deal text message sent accidentally to cop leads to arrests. From the Tyler Morning Telegraph, Longview, Texas.
Message to a Longview police officer led to 24-year-old man and a 19-year-old woman being arrested and charged with possession of marijuana. Officer Jason Hampton received a text message from Sam about 2:15 p.m. Tuesday, quote, in reference to a drug deal, end quote, according to a news release from the Longview Police Department. The news release stated, quote, it was apparent that Sam sent the message to the wrong phone number. Officer Hampton, who was off duty, contacted dispatch and advised them of the situation, end quote. According to the news release, the officer set up a meeting with Sam at a Chase Bank on West Loop 281. When Sam arrived to meet Hampton, officers found a bag containing 4.495 ounces of marijuana inside the vehicle, according to the news release. The news release stated that the driver, Samuel Odom, and the passenger, Sarah Gillette, were arrested and taken to the Greene County Jail. Both were charged with possession of marijuana.
Okay, kids, gather round old Uncle Russ for another dose of common sense for cannabis consumers. Lesson number one, cannabis is illegal. If the man catches you buying it, selling it, transporting it, possessing it, growing it, or smoking it, he will put you in a cage. Lesson number two, when you are doing illegal things, it is best to not have any record of it. That would include videotaping, audio taping, photographs, blog posts, cell phone conversations that can oh so easily be listened into with scanners, and for Cheech and Chong's sake, that most definitely includes text messaging. In fact, if you're smart, you won't even bring your cell phone with you when you make a pickup because that phone's location can be triangulated even when you're not using it, even when it is not turned on. Lesson number three. If you are going to be communicating with someone regarding cannabis using your own cell phone, despite the fact its call log and contact info can be subpoenaed, it's best to not use your real name, Sam.
There were 765,000 marijuana arrests in 2007. That's not for dealers and kingpins, no, that's just for simple possession. Multiply that by the average cost of each arrest, and what have you got? $7.6 billion spent on people just smoking some pot. That's enough money to buy health insurance for every child that needs it. That's enough cash to adopt every stray dog and enough left over to feed it. Mr. Obama, I kinda wrote this song for you. You got my vote for change, now let's see what you can do.
Visit normal.org today. The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your toker tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards.
Support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid, and which claims
are reefer madness?
Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Normal's look at cannabis science. Time for another dose of cannabis science. We're joined again all the way from New York by Dr. Mitch Earlywine, a associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York in Albany. And Dr. Earlywine, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm hoping you're having a good holiday season. How was Thanksgiving for you?
Oh, splendid. Splendid.
Lots to be thankful for, especially with a couple of the court decisions we've seen recently. But what I wanted to talk to you about today was something, we've debunked this so many times, the so-called gateway theory. But it popped up again right near my hometown. I've got a post up on the stash about this billboard that's funded by one of our local anti-drug groups. And it says, "Marijuana, a gateway drug to meth." And then it's got the picture of the guy smoking a joint on one side. Then they got the pockmarked, meth addict on the other side. And I just thought, we should bring you back on so we can tell people the true facts and the real research behind this so-called gateway theory.
I'm happy to discuss it. And we've talked about it before. My friend Ralph Tarter at the University of Pittsburgh has data following folks up over 10 years and some of them even more, showing that, use of cannabis, even heavy use early in life, does not guarantee any kind of use of hard illicit drugs. In truth, some analyses I did years ago suggested that even if you had used cannabis, your chances of using cocaine were less than 1 in 100 and probably closer to 1 in 300.
Mm.
And when you just start looking at the data from just big national drug surveys, we don't have a lot on meth, but heroin, for example, we've got, over 100 million people who've probably tried cannabis in their lives and fewer than 6 million who've used heroin. So obviously, there really isn't much of a gateway. People seem to get confused because we tend to remember examples that fit our stereotypes and forget the ones that don't. So anytime you find somebody who is a heroin addict and ask, did you ever smoke pot, we seem to remember those. The folks who do have problems with hard drugs who haven't used marijuana often either don't end up in these studies, or we just tend to forget about them.
Hmm.
So one of the big studies that came out around 2005 on this, anybody who had used a hard drug before marijuana, they kicked them out of the sample. So, of course, there was not going to be... any evidence against the gateway under those kinds of circumstances. And these studies tend to be really biased against that. And particularly with this one where meth is the issue, my goodness, meth has enough negative consequences on its own that ought to be played up rather than somehow trying to drag marijuana in with a drug that's clearly got a markedly higher dependence potential and a whole lot of horrid negative health consequences.
Mm. Yeah, I've got a theory about this, and I just wanted to get your input on it, too, that here in Oregon, we've got a pretty successful medical marijuana program, and about 8% of our population uses marijuana compared to a national average of about 6%, or depending on which, research you're looking at. So we do tend to have more marijuana users, and it tends to have more marijuana acceptance. On the other hand, out in the rural areas of Oregon, there's a huge problem with meth. We see stories on the news all the time of, the meth people stealing the steel off of bridges and such. So my theory here is that they know they can't convince us that marijuana is as bad as they say it is, so they've got to compare it to meth to put some sort of, spookiness on it, I guess. Do you think that's what's going on?
Absolutely, and in fact, this goes back to the 1930s when old Harry Anslinger was our first drug czar, when it was still the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and he said, marijuana leads to heroin use. The LaGuardia reports that came out in the 1940s suggested this really isn't the case at all. We're talking 60, 70 years ago. We already knew this was wrong, but this is all that folks can come up with anymore to try to make this happen. You can see it's really an absurd argument. And in fact, when you talk to regular users of cannabis, they tend to dislike hard drugs because cannabis is really providing the kind of experience that they want, and these other drugs really don't create anywhere near the same kind of effects.
Yeah, it's like Alan St. Pierre often says that rather than being a gateway, it seems like marijuana is almost a terminus sort of drug.
Well, and the curious thing is, it's very hard to get these published, but we hear time and again cases of folks who've had problems with alcohol or hard drugs turning to cannabis because it has, you know, really markedly fewer negative consequences and arguably none at all. And what a surprise, they don't have to hit these hard drugs if they've got, you know, regular access to clean and you know, appropriate cannabis.
Well, yeah, I've known a few people who have struggled with methamphetamine addiction, and just anecdotally, they've told me that had it not been for cannabis, they don't think they could have kicked or could have gotten off of it. But you say, is there any research on that? Is there anybody that's willing to step forward and do the research on that idea about
As
cannabis?
As you can imagine, these kinds of things are very difficult to get funding
yeah.
for. And the individual case studies are very hard to publish, so everybody sort of brushes it aside as saying, oh, this is just an individual case, it doesn't seem to work. But I've had therapists literally from one end of the country to the other tell me that they've got clients who've succeeded along these lines, and folks who've emailed me time and again saying that this has really been helpful for them. It's unfortunate because people have become more open-minded with things like methadone as a replacement for heroin, or pharmaceutical drugs that people are prescribing in an effort to get folks off prescription stimulants, or, you know, illicit stimulants. But for some reason, the notion that cannabis might actually be an aid to this has really become controversial. I just sent in my latest book on substance abuse treatment alluding to this idea, and I'm eager to see if my editors try to cut it.
You know, that'll be nice to see. And it kind of also goes back to that Swiss vote that we just saw this week, where the Swiss people voted to make permanent their heroin maintenance program at the same time they voted against decriminalizing cannabis. And my thought was, you know, decriminalize the cannabis, you'll have less heroin addicts. Maybe.
It's so funny how that resistance is still there. And that program has been just wonderfully successful and really turned some lives around, saved literally millions of dollars in just emergency room visits and ODs and just all kinds of wild negative health consequences. And yet the resistance to decriminalizing was still there. I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, very, very strange. Now, as I was writing up the post on this, I, of course, had to go out and get some of the links to, of course, the Institute of Medicine from 1999 on this whole gateway theory. And I got this really interesting quote from them where they say, in fact, most drug users begin with alcohol and nicotine before marijuana, usually before they're of legal age. And that is also backed up from a 2003 quote I found in the Journal of the American Medical Association saying that early regular use of tobacco and alcohol emerged as the two factors most consistently associated with later illicit drug use and abuse or dependence. So I'm wondering then, Doctor, why don't they say alcohol and tobacco are the gateway drugs?
The funny thing is, Russ, my friend Linda Collins at Penn State has data suggesting that little kids who drink a lot of caffeine are actually the ones who may be at greatest risk for developing drug problems later on. And I think what this says is it's not really the drugs that do this, it's that there's a subset of folks who just love to do everything. And I'm afraid we all know those people. And what a surprise, they do end up running into problems. But it says a lot more about people than it does about drugs.
So we've got the facts on our side on this. It looks like the research has been done, and all the serious researchers, you know, believe there's really no such thing as this gateway effect. What are we going to do to get this through people's heads, you know, in the public mind, to convince them that this gateway theory is bunk?
This is actually a really common error that people make in logic, where they think if something comes before something else, it's the cause of something else. And I'm afraid I teach this to my four-year-old with the classic game of pull my finger. You know, it's just because something happened first doesn't mean it's a cause. And I feel like we have to keep giving examples like this time and again. The number of churches in a city and the amount of crime in a city tend to co-vary. And in fact, that doesn't mean churches cause crime. You know, we just have to really keep using these outrageous examples until people finally get it through their heads that this is the same messed up logic as we have in pull my finger or in the idea that churches cause crime.
Yeah, I think also what hurts people in trying to uncover the lie behind it is the fact that marijuana is illegal, and since it's illegal and the other drugs are illegal, they figure all illegal kind of goes together. You know, if we can kind of separate their minds from the illegality of it and look at the causes, you know, that the drug itself does not cause the use of another drug, I think that's where we're going to have to go with that.
Well, and in fact, we saw in some of the early data from the Netherlands when they separated the cannabis market from the hard drug market, they did see drops in hard drug use. And I think that in some ways is saying if there was any kind of gateway, it was that people were going to the illicit market as a whole and getting these hard drugs presented to them in a way that was, you know, a product of being in the underground market. Whereas if we had a separate tax and regulated market for cannabis, obviously folks could get that without having exposure to meth and drugs that have, you know, some really harsh problems associated with their use.
Yeah, or as I like to say, you know, marijuana is not a gateway to hard drugs. Marijuana is a gateway to hard drug dealers.
Exactly. Very well put. And then people tend to forget the, you know, folks like Allen Ginsberg, who shot heroin first and then used cannabis. And he said, yep, heroin, it's a gateway drug.
Well, Dr. Lewine, thanks for joining us. And before we go, you know, we just got through the Thanksgiving season. And of course, Christmas is coming up. And, you know, those of us in the cannabis community already have somewhat of a battle with what we call the munchies. And of course, holiday, the munchies are very, very fat and calorie laden. So any tips on helping us get through these holiday seasons and staying in the same pants or dress size?
The impact of cannabis on appetite is very real, as folks who saw Carl Hart's presentation at the Normal Conference in October realize, yes, indeed, if you are using cannabis, you do tend to consume more calories. The big picture on this, of course, is there's an opportunity to wait until after you've eaten in order to go ahead and fire up the vaporizer, and I think that can be really adaptive for a lot of folks. The other thing that's really a wonderful lesson of this plan is let's really pay attention to our food under the circumstances. Take bites about the size of your thumbnail, tend to really relish them, enjoy them, talk about them with your friends, how good the food tastes, rather than just woofing it down in front of the TV, and what a surprise you find, you enjoy the meal more and actually consume less. It takes a while for your brain to register that your stomach's actually full, and so we need to sort of spread the meal out a little bit and give yourself a little bit of time. Some adaptive things that a colleague of mine, Drew Anderson here, who studies eating, has found is that basically if you put a little bit on your plate, walk away from the big table, eat that little bit, and then make it so you have to decide to actually get up and go get more before you do, people tend to consume less. And it's an amazing opportunity to see how if you quit a little bit before you actually feel full, you find you don't feel completely nauseated later on.
Those are good tips for any time of the year, but especially the holidays. And I guess my tip would be get yourself one of those gas mask bongs. It's really hard to eat when those are strapped on. Dr. Lewine, thanks for joining us again here on the Daily Audio Stash. We'll talk to you next week.
Looking forward to it.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our Daily Audio Stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. Thanks for tuning in to this Best of Normal Daily Audio Stash episode. We really appreciate it. And remind you that we'll be back with new shows on June 8, 2009. In the meantime, get involved. Join Normal at NORML.org today. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.